and sort it out if people have a problem. Can you hear me okay? Great. Thank you. I've got my glasses today, so I'm slightly better off than I was before. So, let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the stories that you have in it of people that you want us to learn from. And I pray that we'll learn today from Joseph. Amen. Okay, so we've been working our way through the patriarchs in the Bible. We started with Adam. Then we got to very quickly run on to Abraham. And then we've finally got to Joseph. And we've spent 2 weeks already in Joseph. The first one, we covered his dreams and how God spoke to him at an early age and started him basically walking in a certain direction. How his brothers hated him because of that, and how sometimes if you're faithfully following God, people aren't necessarily seeing that as sweet honey in the rock. And so he was sold to the Egyptians. Then we saw that when he was in the service of Potiphar, his wife, Potiphar's wife, took a shine to him. And we dealt last week, or the last time I spoke, with the whole problem of dealing with sexual temptation. So we're going to finish off Joseph this week by just looking generally at his life, the power of an ordinary life. Because to be honest, Joseph's life was ordinary. And for a large part of it, he was just an irk working as a servant in somebody's house, as a slave. You know, he wasn't anybody really. And many of us feel that about ourselves. We feel, you know, well, you know, I'm just a nobody. I'm nobody outside a certain circle of people knows me. I'm not very influential. I'm not very powerful. You know, I'm just here and I have to just carry on. And, you know, that was Joseph. Joseph was in that position as well. Now, later on, he got raised up into great power and authority in the Egyptian Empire. But for most of his life, it wasn't like that. And to be honest, if you think about it, for Jesus, it was the same. You know, for the first 30 years of Jesus' life, he was a nobody. He was just a carpenter, you know, or an artisan of some sort. We're not sure exactly, but we all think he's a carpenter, but the word actually could have been a stonemason as well. But he built things. He made things, you know, built houses or whatever. But we don't know anything more about him. We just know he lived a fairly ordinary life, except for one thing. That whenever he came to be baptized by John, the Holy Spirit came down and a voice came from heaven and it said, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." And I think that's great because it shows that God can be well pleased with an ordinary life. You don't have to be famous. You don't have to be hugely influential or known by lots of people. You just have to be somebody that God's well pleased with. And there's no great criteria for that, other than knowing God. So, let's look at Joseph. So, I want to start by just asking you a couple of questions, really, just to think about. You know, what are Christians for? You know, you get saved and you get baptized, and you may go to church then, and then people tell you you've got to read your Bible, and, you know, you've got to give money, things like that. But, you know, that tends to be the sum total of what people think, you know, being a Christian's for. It's like it's something that you do on Sundays, but it doesn't really affect you the rest of the week particularly, you know. You know, I heard somebody saying, you know, they gave up drugs for what? God, they gave me meetings, you know. And there's this sort of sense of people, you know, becoming a Christian and joining the church, and then everything surrounds the church. You know, the church is like, you know, we've got to go to meetings, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. Your whole life centers on the church. And you think, well, you know, is this it? Is this what it's about? Is this who I am? Am I just here to do stuff in or around or about church? You know, what does it mean to be a Christian? What's a Christian for? You know, for those of us who are sort of from an evangelical background, you know, we obviously take the Great Commission seriously. That's a bit at the end of Matthew when Jesus says, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you." And, you know, we usually take that as our text. You know, that's what we've got to do. We've got to go and make disciples. We've got to go and you know, evangelize, and we've got to reach out to people and all that. And so that tends to characterize churches like our church. Other churches are perhaps a little bit more sacramental, and they don't put such an emphasis on, you know, evangelism or activism or going out and doing things. But we tend to be very active, you know, very busy. We plan things, and we think of things we ought to do, and have projects, and build buildings, and, you know, do all sorts of things. And they're not bad things. They're good things, but, you know, that tends to be the way we think of ourselves. That's what a Christian's for. It's to be something. And you know, the problem is that when we think that way, most Christians sort of subconsciously create a hierarchy of the worthiness of occupations. And we sort of think, you know, well, you know, if you're really called and you're a real missionary, you know, a real person, you know, you'll be a missionary. You know, so the first on the list is missionary. And then you might have, well, you know, I'm not going to be a missionary, but I might be an ordained minister, you know, I might be a pastor in the church. And then you think, well, you know, if I'm not going to be that, well, maybe I'll do something socially helpful. You know, I'll be a doctor or a teacher or somebody who, you know, nurse or something like that, something, you know, good to help people. But if not that, you know, well, maybe sort of helpful activities, you know, like maybe homemaking. Or maybe I'll do clean work, you know. I'll do honest day's labor. I'll do a trade, you know. I'll be a plumber, or I'll be a something. You know, it's like, you know, it's not very exciting work, but it's honest work. It's clean work, you know. And I'll do that. And then of course, you know, if you're really down the heap, you know, the lowest of, I might do dirty work, like I'll be in business, you know, and I'll make money, and I'll be a banker or something like that. And, you know, and people don't necessarily, you know, consciously think that way, but you know, you talk to people and that's the way they think about their lives. You know, I'm a pastor, you know, I'm serving God in the church. I'm a banker. I don't tell people what I do, you know, or anything in between. And it's crazy because, you know, only 1% of us could ever be resourced to be working in the church, to be a pastor, a minister, or something like that. Everybody else has to do other things. You know, everybody else has to, you know, go out and earn a living and find a job. Or if you're retired, you've done a bit of that, but now, you know, you're finding other things to do in your life. But, you know, you only spend 2 hours a week in church, you know, if you're lucky. Others spend hours and hours and hours doing meetings and things, but, you know, it's really a small part of your life, you know. So the question is, okay, we do this on Sunday, that's fine, but what are we for? What are we meant to be doing the rest of the time? What's it all about? And, you know, I think Joseph actually has a lot to tell us about that, really, because, as I said, he was an ordinary person who pleased God in his life, but he wasn't called to be a pastor or a minister or anything like that. He was just an ordinary person who was serving God. Now, the other thing I think it's worth thinking about, maybe it's good thinking about now while we're sort of pondering this question of pastors, is the question of you know, what are pastors for, or what are laity for? Now, you know, up until 300 years after the start of the church, there was no clergy and laity. There wasn't. There was just the people of God. And what happened was that whenever Constantine became Caesar, he became a Christian. And he appointed bishops around the basically in the same geographical areas that they had a sort of administrative areas in the empire. And so these bishops were sort of appointed into a kind of quasi-legal role to sort of look after the church. And then what happened was that the church gradually got some ideas about communion and what eventually became the Mass. And so the idea came that, you know, this was a special thing, and you had to have a special person who served the Mass or the sacrament, and so you had to be ordained, and so what you ended up with was you know, an ordained group of people who were the only people who could give communion, who were appointed, you know, by the empire, who were kind of in charge, and there was a hierarchy of them, you know, bishops, prelates, whatever, down to you know, the minister in the church. But they were set aside, they were ordained and set aside as being separate from the ordinary people. And then we had the Reformation, which basically they came back to the idea of the priesthood of all believers, and they said, you know, well, a lot of these ideas are not right. In fact, if I read you out a little bit of it, you know, Luther argued that even the milkmaid or the tailor with the word of God in her hands are able to please God and minister the things of God as effectively as a priest, prelate, or even the Pope himself. And so, you know, they kind of said, look, we don't need this hierarchy. This is something that didn't exist back in the early church. It came about through various social means. Now, I have to say, if you talk to a Catholic theologian, you have a very different perspective on this than the one I'm giving you now. But, you know, because there are those that do believe, and even in the Church of England, to be honest, you know, that priest has been ordained. It's something that's given by the church or whatever. But it can be argued that that wasn't the way it was in the early church at the beginning, that this was something that was imposed later on. But it's interesting, too, that, you know, whenever, you know, the Reformation happened and, you know, Baptists like us or whatever came around, you know, what happened was actually that the preacher replaced the priest. And so instead of the sacramental thing being the Mass, you know, when the body became the blood of Christ and all the rest, it actually went the other way. It was now, it was the sermon was the sacramental thing. We can hear God through this person who's been ordained to tell us about God. And this person has been trained, they've gone to Bible college, they've done whatever, 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 and God has called them. And because they're called, they're now able to offer this to us so that we can receive the word of God and be fed. So we kind of replaced one type of ordination, which was in order to handle the Mass, with another type of ordination, which was to be able to handle the word. But the argument goes, and this I'm taking from somebody called Paul Stevens, who wrote a book called The Abolition of the Laity and a few other things like that, is that actually that's not the way it was in the early church. That actually, you know, the people of God, the word laity, laos, comes from the Greek word laos, and it was something of that everybody was. Everybody was a prophet and a priest and a king. And everybody had a calling to do that out in their normal lives, in the world, in the work. So whereas Clement of Alexandria, he, and following this idea of having, priests in the church, he actually took the Old Testament priests and said, this is the way the church should be. We take this model of Levites, people set apart, and we'll make them priests. Clement said that, and that kind of got into Catholic teaching and all the rest. And up today to even now, that wasn't the way it was at all. Before that, it was, you know, that priesthood in the Old Testament had been done away with because Jesus was the great high priest, so the priesthood was no longer needed. And we, the people of God, the laity of God, were also the priesthood in that priesthood of Jesus. All of us, every single one of us, not one of us being more able to know God or to share God with somebody than anybody else, all of us being prophets, priests, and kings. So God's call to Christians in 1 Peter 2 verse 9 is, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. So, you know, prophets, well, they declare the praises of him, right? Priests, well, what are priests, a royal priesthood? Well, priests pray for people, and they bring forgiveness and reconciliation into situations. And and to be honest, in the Old Testament, the priests were also the doctors. If you had an ailment and you went to the priest and he declared whether you were healed or not. So they were the doctors as well. They would pray for you and anoint you. So they were healing. And then kings. Well, what's a royal priesthood? Well, a royal priesthood is a king who's a priest, right? So you exercise influence, you exercise power, and you bring about justice and righteousness. Now, that's the calling that's on each of us, all of us, individually, and also on each of us as a corporate body. All of us are that. Now, you may work that out in different circumstances. You know, one person might be the prime minister and another person might, you know, be the cleaning lady in the school. But you're still a prophet, priest, and king. It's just you happen to be doing it in that place. So your calling is not to be the prime minister or even a pastor or even a whatever. Your calling is to be a prophet, priest, and king. That's just your calling. And then you work it out in something that you actually do. But that's not who you are. Who you are is this prophet, priest, and king. And that's very empowering, because that actually means that you realize that God has called you to this life, to this circle of friends that you're around, to these people around. And he's called you to be a prophet and a priest and a king for them. For, you know, who else is going to pray for your friends and family? Who else is going to tell them anything about God? You're uniquely placed among the people that you know where you are. I don't know them. You don't know people I know. I work with people in North America. You'll never meet them. They actually come to my birthday party, one or two of them. But, you'll never meet them, sort of thing. That's fine. That's okay. You don't have to deal with them. They're not your responsibility. But you have people that you know that I'll never meet. Everybody has a unique circle of, and even Barack Obama only knows about 200 people personally, right? Everybody knows him. These famous people, they're all known by everybody. But, you know, reality, we all only know about 200 people, really. And those are our primary circle of influence that we can be a prophet, a priest, and a king for. So, in my first talk, I talked about how Joseph had this dream that sort of marked him out as a prophet. And later on it says, when his brothers come to him, "So it was not you sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, the lord of all his house, and the ruler of all the land of Egypt." You know, he recognized that his situation was something that God had done to him. I mean, the brothers had meant it for bad. He says elsewhere, "You meant it for bad, but God meant it for good." And so he knew that his situation was a situation that God had put him in. And the question then was, what was he going to do in that situation? Now, my second talk, was all about, it was a bit about sex, but it really wasn't about that. It was about self-control. Because the first thing he had to learn was to be self-controlled. He knew that he was called to be this person, prophet, priest, king, whatever. But, what could stop him from doing that? Well, lack of self-discipline. And so a lot of the time, you think Christians, people say, Christians are always telling us what to do. They're always saying, you mustn't do this, you mustn't do that, you mustn't do the other, Well, yeah, you probably shouldn't do those things. But the reason why you shouldn't do them is because they get in the way of you being the person you're meant to be. Paul says, lay aside everything so that I may run the race. You're not going to run the race, with a big sack of coal on your back. You're not going to, you're going to train. You're going to lay aside stuff that you don't need. And so, when people get involved in basically, lust, for an example, which was last week's one, it's really just stopping them from doing what they're meant to be doing. In Proverbs 31, I'll just read it out. "It's not for kings to drink wine, not for kings to crave beer, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and deprive the oppressed of their rights. Let beer be for those who are perishing, wine for those who are anguished. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more." It's what it's saying is, well, people drink, right? And quite often they drink to forget. But that's not you. Don't you go out and get drunk. You're a king. Kings don't get drunk. Why do you not get drunk? Because you're meant to exercise judgment. You're meant to be out there doing good for folk. And these poor people are lost and they'll get drunk and whatever, but that's because their lives are miserable. But it's not you. You've got light. You've got truth in your life. You don't have to do that. You've got something else, something better. So it says, do not get drunk with wine, but do not release the debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit, right? You've got a calling on your life and you've got the Spirit within you. You don't have to do that. You don't have to, like Joseph, commit adultery or whatever. You got to lay that aside. But to be honest, you lay it aside so you can do the thing you're meant to do. The big thing is not, "I became a Christian so that I wouldn't have sex with somebody outside of marriage." Well, no, I didn't, right? I became a Christian so that I would serve God. And because I'm going to serve God, I'm not going to have sex outside of marriage. It's a different thing, right? Turns your life upside down in terms of what you're doing. Now, faithfulness is also something that you know, we need to continue to be in the face of disappointment. So, you know, let me just read forwards a little bit in Joseph. So, the Lord was with Joseph, so he prospered, and he lived in the house of the Egyptian master. When his master saw the Lord was with him, the Lord gave him success in everything he did. And Joseph found favor in his eyes and became an attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and entrusted his care to everything he owned. From the time he put in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. So when Joseph was with Potiphar, he did a good job. And then later on, when he's put in prison, the Lord was with him and showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warder. So the warder put Joseph in charge of all those who were in prison. You know, the warder paid no attention to anything on Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph. Now, the thing is, Joseph was a slave and he'd been taken away from his family, and he would have been perfectly justified, you know, under those circumstances to be a pretty recalcitrant slave, you know, just I'll do it, but I'm not going to do it with any grit, you know. I'm not going to be a great employee here because I'm not being paid. He could have done that, but that's not what he did. What he did was he said, you know what, in these circumstances, when I'm serving Potiphar, I'm serving God. And actually, you know, later on in Colossians, when there's again talking to slaves, it says, slaves, obey your masters in everything, and do not only when their eye is on you to curry their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence to the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. You know, not slaves. Now, we don't have slavery now, and we could have a whole discussion about whether the Bible approves of slavery or not, which it doesn't, but that's by the way. But the point is that, you know, even as a slave, Joseph didn't say, well, you know, this is unjust. I'm not going to be a good slave. He said, I'm going to serve as well as I can in these circumstances because I'm serving God. And that is often what we're called to be as well, just faithful. So here's the thing. Are you faithful in small things? You know, when you say you'll do something, do you do it? You know, are you somebody that's reliable? Do you know, there's people that, you know, when they show up, you think, oh, my goodness, this person has arrived, because I know that they'll do their best and they'll make things happen. And if they said they're going to do it, they'll be there more or less on time, and they'll try and make it happen, and they'll do as good a job as they can. They may not be brilliant, but it'll be, you know, I'm glad that they're there. And there are other people that you don't bother asking them anymore, frankly, because, you know, you ask them to do something, may or may not be done, but you no reliability on it, you know. And so the question is, who are you? Are you the kind of, can't be bothered? Or are you the person that everything you do it with all your heart as unto the Lord? In which case, people are glad that you showed up. I want to show you this video. Let me just check if it's going to work. How Joseph became the prime minister. Sometime later, the cupbearer and baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. Now, it's interesting to conjecture what the problem was. Cupbearer to the king, baker to the king. What could possibly have gone wrong? Right. I think that they all had a very bad case of gastroenteritis. And the king was offended by this. And I think that part of the reason later on when it says that you know, the king brought them out again before them, and he kind of, you know, he punished the baker and killed him, the other guy he lifted up. It says that he did it at the king's birthday party. And I can just imagine that the first time they offended him, they, you know, it caused him and all his guests to go home sick. And so the next time he had a big meal, he said, right, these two, out. And, you know, that's when he sort of punished the baker with these circumstances. So, are we there yet? Yes? Great, okay.
Welcome to the Museum of Procrastination. This is where we honor good intentions that never fully materialized. Follow me, please. Ellie? The gym membership section. To be precise, The memberships that were used once and then spent the rest of their lives in wallets. This one I find particularly moving. The unfinished novels. What a waste of talent. A moment of silence, please. Thank you. Musical instruments that have only played Vera Jacka. This way. Millions of ideas, inventions, eureka moments. Some could revolutionize the way we live our lives. Or priorities.
Sorry. Okay, so I'll go jump back again. So that's a great wee advert, I think, for HSBC. But the point is this procrastination. And it's really just saying, okay, if your life is a call from God, are you just going to sort of sit on your hands? Or as Joseph, are you going to proactively go out there and live it and make a difference and do stuff with the gifting that you have in the circumstances that you're in? Now, so cut a long story short, Joseph, the cupbearer and the baker both came to Joseph and said they had a dream. And Joseph interpreted their dreams and said the cupbearer would be cupbearer again to the king, but that the baker would be killed by the king, right? And lo and behold, that's what happened. But what happened then was that Joseph said, you know, but when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh, get me out of this prison. I was forcibly carried off to the land of the Hebrews, and even here, I've done nothing to deserve being put in the dungeon. So Joseph sees his opportunity to get out of jail, but he's forgotten. It says, you know, that he forgot. The chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. And so a disappointment for Joseph. And, you know, life's like that. There's times when you think, you know, and actually you can think, you know, God's really going to do something for me now. You know, things are going to change. It's all going to whatever, whatever. And then it all goes pear-shaped. And it isn't the way you thought it was going to be at all. And so Joseph just carried on being faithful, even though he'd suffered this big disappointment, because here was his opportunity, and his opportunity turned into nothing. And, you know, Screwtape Letters is a great book. And in it, Screwtape's like, he's a senior devil, and he's telling a junior devil how to tempt a Christian. And he says to the senior to the junior devil, the enemy, that's Jesus, the enemy has guarded him from you through this first great wave of temptations, but if only you can be kept alive, you have time itself for your ally. The long, dull, monotonous years of middle-aged prosperity or middle-aged adversity are great campaigning weather. You see, it is so hard for these creatures to persevere. The routine of adversity, the gradual decay of youthful loves and youthful hopes, the quiet despair hardly felt as pain of ever overcoming the chronic temptations with which they have again and again been defeated, the drabness that we create in their lives, and the inarticulate resentment with which they teach them to respond, all this provides admirable opportunities for wearing out a soul by attrition. And you know, that could have been Joseph's response. He could have just taken all of these disappointments and said, you know, well, sod it, I'm going to give up. But he didn't. He kept on being faithful, kept on following the Lord. 2 years later, the king had a dream. And as we know, the dream was of seven cows that were very fat and then seven cows that were very lean. And that this represented, you know, the famine that was going to come on Egypt. And what happened was that the king had this dream and he didn't know what to do with it. And he asked all his advisors, and they didn't know what it meant either, but he was obviously very disturbed by it. And so he asked, what happened was that the cupbearer suddenly came back to his senses and remembered, and he said, King, there's somebody in prison who told me what was going to happen in my life. I think he can interpret this dream. And so Joseph is brought into the king, and he says, actually, I can't interpret this dream, but God can interpret this dream. What it means is that these seven good cows or good years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine will come. And what you must do is appoint somebody to during these good years of plenty, store up treasure, store up the grain, and so that when the 7 years of famine come, then you will be able to feed the people and keep the country alive. And so the king's so impressed by Joseph and his advice, he turns to his other advisors, and between them they agree that Joseph actually, because God has shown him this, could be the only possible person who's wise enough to be able to administer the kingdom during this time. And so he appoints Joseph from being a prisoner and a slave to being the prime minister of Egypt. Sudden meteoric rise on the way up. And totally unexpected, absolutely not what Joseph was expecting. Interestingly, the cupbearer had actually mentioned him to the king before then, he'd have been out of prison in a way. So in fact, the fact that he'd been kept back 2 years brought him to the right time to be able to actually interpret the dream. And so it was God's blessing on him and on the nation that he actually stayed an extra couple of years until times were ready for this to happen. So Joseph then was appointed as effectively now the king in Egypt. You know, he was in charge. He was the prime minister. The Pharaoh didn't need to worry about anything because Joseph was worrying about it. So here we are, a man who was a prophet, all these dreams and this knowledge of God. He was a priest. I'll come on to that in a sec. And he was a king because now he was in charge and God had put him in that place of influence to bring about great good in the country. Priest, that's interesting. Was he a priest? Well, I said at the beginning, priest brings about reconciliation and healing. And I don't know about you, but you know, when you read the story of Joseph and we get to the end of it, you have this very strange few chapters of all this business with the brothers. What on earth is going on with these brothers? So let me read again. When Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down and buy some for us so that they may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was governor in the land, the person who sold grain to all the people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You're spies. You've come here to spy out the land where the land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come here to buy food. We're sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you've come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father and one is no more." Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you, you're spies, and this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. I will send one of your number to get your brother. The rest you will be kept in prison so that your word may be tested to see if you're telling the truth. If you're not, then surely as Pharaoh lives, you're spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that the words may be verified and that he may not die." They said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded for his life, but we would not listen. That's why the distress has come upon us." And Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen to me. Now we must give an account for his blood." He did not realize that Joseph could understand him, for he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then came back and spoke to them again. You know, so what's going on here? The story goes on. So he accuses them to be spies. He then sends them back with grain, but when they go back with the grain, they find there's money in the bags, and so they go back to Joseph and say, what's happened? He tells them he won't see Joseph or Reuben unless you bring back Benjamin. They go back and get Benjamin, and eventually they return with Benjamin. But when they come back with Benjamin, Joseph puts a cup in Benjamin's bag, and it's like then Benjamin is accused of being the guy, and he says, all the rest of you can go, but Benjamin's the thief because he's stolen this cup. And then what happens actually is that Judah offers to take Benjamin's place. He says, so now if the boy is not with us, when we go back to our servant, the father, and my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees the boy's in there, he will die. Your servant guarantees the boy's life to my father. If I don't bring him back, he could have my life. So then, please let your servant remain in my lord's place, my lord's slave, in place of the boy. Now, so what's happened is that the brothers have come to see this as a punishment for their sin. And then they've come to be confronted with the fact that they're going to cause their father even more pain. And instead of causing him more pain, they've said, no, we're going to take the rap. We'll take the place of the father, of Benjamin, so that Benjamin can go back. And what this is actually doing is it's bringing the brothers to understand the gravity of what they've done. And bringing them to understand, the pain that they've caused their father, and bringing them to repent of that, and to change their behavior, and to change the way they act. And so this whole thing about, it's interesting, Judah offers to put his life in place of Benjamin's. Well, Judah is the type of Jesus, because Jesus is a descendant of Judah. Jesus put himself in place of us. Just an interesting aside. But the point is, what's going on is what we call restorative justice. What Joseph is doing, without telling his brothers who he is at this point, is he is bringing them to understand the gravity of what they've done, bringing them to understand that they need to change their lives, and then ultimately what he does is he reveals himself to them. When Joseph could control himself no longer, before all his attendants, he cried out, "Make everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph. And he made himself known to his brothers, and he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him and told Pharaoh's household. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But the brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Now, again, if he told them straight off, he couldn't have done all of this. If he told them, he couldn't have, they would have just been terrified, right? But what he did was he put them through what looks like a cat and mouse game, but actually is about changing their hearts and helping them to understand that he could do anything to punish them, but he was not going to do it. He had forgiven them, but he wanted them to come to a place of reconciliation. And, so that's what what restorative justice is about. It's bringing people to recognize the enormity of their wrong and putting people right again, putting them right with each other. It cost Joseph a lot to forgive his brothers. It says he wept bitterly, even just during this process, but he was committed to binding up that which was broken, and he very, very wisely did it. And we look at it, and we kind of have to think about what's going on, but it's actually incredibly wise how he's treating them. Now, do you know what happens after Jacob dies? When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "If Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for the wrongs we did him." So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father has left his instructions before he dies. This is what you're to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants." And when their message came to them, Joseph wept. And Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid." So even after all of this, they still had this suspicion in their minds that Joseph actually bore them a grudge. It was only because their father was alive he was still looking out for them. But he'd actually forgiven them. And it grieved him that they didn't believe that. Now, just again as an aside, we're forgiven by God. But quite often we act just like this. We say, well, if God ever knew, or if God's punishing me, God's bringing this bad stuff upon me. God, you know, they were saying God's punishing me for what's happened to Joseph years ago. But actually, God isn't punishing them. He's doing quite the opposite. He's feeding them. He's providing for their families. And he's bringing reconciliation with Joseph. But they thought they couldn't see. And even later on in their lives, they were just so hardened in their hearts, they couldn't understand that Joseph had actually really forgiven them and was doing them good. Now, that's reconciliation. Somebody said, if we Christians can't speak the message of reconciliation, we've got nothing to say. And our priesthood is actually about reconciliation between us and God and reconciliation between us as people. And that is what our calling is. So if your family's divided, if your brother's not speaking to your mother or whatever, that needs reconciliation. On this estate, people are in a mess. Every family's got things they don't talk about or things that are broken. Prophets, priests, and kings deal with that. They go out and they bring justice. They tell people what God really says. And they bring reconciliation. And they do it at a cost, which is what Joseph did, because he wept. It wasn't an easy thing to do. That's what we're called to do. That's who we're called to be. Now, some people might be given time, employed full time to do that. But really, the reality is it's all of us who are meant to be doing that. It's all of us who are meant to be that. And that really is the story of Joseph, an ordinary man who knew God and who was faithful in his life at the beginning, just not to go off some wild parties, but also faithful to learn about and follow God. And just in all of his life, just did the best he could. So whenever he became, prime minister, because he'd run somebody's house previously, he knew how to run the country. He'd learnt that job. So let me just read this final little bit, which is Jacob's blessing on Joseph. And I want to ask you to put your name in the place of Joseph, okay? Joseph is a fruitful vine. A fruitful vine near a spring, whose branches climb over a wall. With bitterness, archers attacked him. They shot him with hostility. But his bow remained steady, his strong arm stayed supple. Because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, because of the shepherd, the rock of Israel, because of your father's God who helps you, because of the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of the skies above, blessings of the deep springs below, and blessings of the breasts and the womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessings of the ancient mountains, than the bounty of the age-old hills. Let all these rest on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the prince among his brothers. And I'd say to you, you are a fruitful vine, a fruitful vine near a spring. And let all these blessings rest on your head, that you might be a blessing to others like Joseph is. But that is our calling. That is why we're here. That's what we're meant to do.
Thank you, Craig.